John will return to Fresh Air next Wednesday at 3:30 with another edition of The Record Show. Tomorrow at 3:30, Francis Davis will be with us for his weekly review of new jazz releases. And Friday at 3:30, Bill Van Wert will be here. He's going to review the new film, Missing. It's 2 minutes to 4 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 91 FM on your dial. If you have any comments that you'd like to pass on to any of our contributors here in Fresh Air, drop us a line. Our address is WUHY, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, 19106. Well, last week, the Senate Judiciary Committee passed the Hatch Amendment. If passed by Congress, this amendment would allow the federal and state governments to create legislation restricting or outlawing abortion. If a state's law was more restrictive than the federal law, the more restrictive state law would apply in that state. Coming up, we're going to discuss the issue of abortion from the viewpoint of obstetrician-gynecologists, the medical professionals closest to the issue. With me are two obstetrician-gynecologists with opposing opinions. Dr. Jane Hodgson is the medical director of the Midwest Center for Women in Minneapolis. Since the 1960s, she has advocated a woman's right to choose abortion when lobbying efforts for pro-choice legislation failed in the late 60s. She participated in what she described as an act of enlightened resistance by performing an illegal abortion on a mother of three who had contracted German measles in the fourth week of her pregnancy and feared birth defects. Hodgson was arrested. This test case was rendered moot in 1973 when the Supreme Court legalized abortion. She's now on a lecture tour on behalf of the Ms. Foundation for Women, and she's the editor of the book Abortion and Sterilization, published by the Academic Press. Dr. Ed Sullivan is an obstetrician-gynecologist at Riddle Memorial Hospital in Media. He's an associate clinical professor of obstetrics gynecology at Thomas Jefferson Medical College. Dr. Sullivan is opposed to abortion. He has never performed one and would never recommend one. He's a member of Pennsylvanians for Human Life. He's been practicing since 1957. I'm going to speak with each of these doctors separately, and then we'll be speaking with both of them and opening up the phones for your questions. We flipped a coin just a couple of minutes ago to help decide who should speak first, and I'll be speaking first with Dr. Ed Sullivan. I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let me ask you why you're opposed to abortion.
Well, I'm opposed to abortion because I feel it's the taking of an innocent human life, and I feel it's a tragedy when any innocent human life is taken.
When you started practicing, abortion was illegal. How did you feel when abortion was legalized through the 1973 Supreme Court decision?
Very disappointed.
Why?
Well, I'm disappointed because I think this is the wrong way for the country to go. I think this institutionalized homicide.
How did it change your profession or the expectations of you as an obstetrician-gynecologist? Did it change it at all?
It changed my view a little bit of medicine. After all, we had always been the disciples of Hippocrates. And, of course, when you finish medical school, you take the Hippocratic Oath. And all my medical school did, where I teach, was take out that portion of the Hippocratic Oath that proscribed abortion. And I felt that this was a failure on their part to live up to the traditions that medicine had sought and stood for so long.
Did it change the expectations your patients had from you?
Well, I don't think it changed the expectations that my patients had from me.
Okay.
Because my patients are pretty well aware of my views on it.
Have you ever been asked or pressured to perform an abortion in
your medical practice? I've been asked, but I wouldn't say pressured. I've been asked.
How do you say no when you're an obstetrician-gynecologist when you're asked to perform an abortion?
Well, I say no because I tell them what my views are, that I feel that this is an independent life and that it's an innocent life and that it should not be just summarily taken.
Is it accepted or do you feel that is it ever held against you on the hospital, or is it accepted for every gynecologist to be able to make up their own mind about how they feel?
I never felt that it was held against me, no.
Could you ever foresee a job situation where it would be, or do you think that OBGYNs are really assured that freedom of choice for participating or not participating in abortion?
Well, it is one of my fears that sometime down the line, pressure would be brought to bear. There is slight pressure even now in our residency training programs. Hospitals which do not perform abortions, that is a discredit to them, if you will, if they do not perform One of the things that they say, they do not have a termination of pregnancy. They don't adequately teach termination of pregnancy. So there's a little pressure there. And, of course, I'm opposed to that, too.
So it's a skill that students wouldn't be able to learn there who are interning, is that it?
Yes, that's what the American Board says.
Have you seen anything in your practice that has strengthened your stand against abortion? You've been practicing since 1957.
Yes. Yes, I have. The new science of neonatology has really strengthened my views. I think it's amazing that they can take babies that weigh a pound, that are 28 weeks gestation, and the vast majority of these babies are able to be saved and become perfectly normal human beings.
As a doctor, what do you feel your loyalty should be to the woman who is your patient and to the fetus that she's carrying if she's pregnant?
Well, I feel they're both my patients. I feel when a woman comes into my office, I have two patients, she and her baby.
Is there ever a situation where your loyalty to each calls for a decision that's going to be difficult to make?
No, I don't think so. You're bringing up the old saw, I think, about the mother's life or the baby's life. I see no situation where that would be possible. I cannot think of a scenario where you would really have a choice between the mother's life and the baby's life.
Have you ever had a patient whose life was endangered by the pregnancy?
By the pregnancy? Oh, certainly. Oh, certainly. Pregnancy itself endangers your life. So does driving your car. You know, they're all calculated risks.
But, I mean, someone whose medical condition really meant that the pregnancy would be a life-endangering experience.
Well, I guess there are complications of pregnancy which, of course, endanger the patient's life. And I have seen those, of course, but they can be handled without abortion.
What do you tell a woman who is asking for advice about whether to carry to term or to abort?
Well, of course, my advice is all on the positive side, that they should not abort. And the reasons that I tell them that, this is their child that they're carrying. This is a separate human being from them. It's not really part of their body. It's somebody that they've been given, that's been entrusted to them, and that they shouldn't betray that trust, that all of us ought to have a chance to have a nice, normal life.
What if a woman who is your patient disagrees and wants to seek an abortion? What would happen?
Well, there's nothing I can do really to stop them, is there?
So she'd seek the...
Oh, she would probably leave me and go elsewhere, yes.
Okay. What role do you think a doctor should play in the decision of whether a woman carries to term or has an abortion?
Well, of course, I feel that they should play the advocate for both of his patients, for both the woman and for her fetus.
Have you been participating politically in the issue of abortion?
Well, I belong to an organization which is really an educational organization rather than a lobbying one, Pennsylvanians for Human Life. And what we do is give presentations at schools and home and school associations, civic organizations and clubs like that, trying to get across our point of view about this issue that... We regard the fetus as a human being, and it should not be summarily dispensed with.
Do you think it's incumbent upon doctors who have strong beliefs to act on them in an issue such as this?
Absolutely.
Is the issue dividing the medical field?
I don't know. I think there are strong feelings on both sides. So far, I don't feel that some people disagree with me strongly on the issue, and I think we've still remained colleagues and friends. People with whom I'm not friendly, I don't know how they would feel about it.
Right. Okay. I'm speaking with Dr. Ed Sullivan, and he's an obstetrician-gynecologist at Riddle Memorial Hospital in Media, and he's also on the faculty of Thomas Jefferson Medical College. And we'll be getting back to Dr. Sullivan in just a few minutes. Also with me is Dr. Jane Hodgson. She's the director of the Midwest Medical Center for Women in Minneapolis. Welcome, Dr. Hodgson, to Fresh
Air. Thank you.
Why are you for the right of a woman to choose abortion?
I think that reproductive rights, freedom of choice, is extremely important to the proper health care for women. It affects women's health tremendously in many ways. And I've become convinced of this through my over 30 years of practice because I have seen so many cases of problem pregnancy. I think as a woman, I probably, and as a sympathetic, hopefully empathetic mother myself, I see many of these patients. And over the years, I gradually became to see that the restrictive abortion law in Minnesota was a very archaic and immoral law, which caused a great deal of suffering. And there was considerable hypocrisy. There was a double standard of medicine. The rich could afford to go outstate and have their abortions, whereas the poor could not. The damage to these women from criminal abortions was outstanding. The wards were filled with pelvic inflammatory disease as a result of criminal abortions. And I gradually became educated, so to speak, as to this point of view.
You have done or supervised how many abortions?
Thousands. Probably about 40,000 in the last 10 years that I've supervised.
Has presiding over that many abortions affected your opinion in any way?
Not in the least. My patients keep reinforcing it. All I have to do is to see a problem pregnancy. And I am any soul searching I may have done, my ideas are reinforced by the problems of that patient.
What's an example of a problem pregnancy?
Well, I saw one that I saw 2 days ago, a Vietnamese refugee that has had 4 children, and she was 44 years old. It had been 11 years since she had been pregnant, and she was on welfare and struggling very hard in a new country. Had only been here a short time. She had seen one of my colleagues who was anti-abortion and who was trying to prevent her from having an abortion. As it turned out, she had a mole. It was not a pregnancy in the true sense of the word, a mole being an overgrowth of the placental tissue, which is a low-grade type of tumor. And this is an example of this woman had scarcely enough money to feed her 4 children because our welfare payments are low, and it really would have been a major problem with her.
What role do you think an obstetrician gynecologist should play in helping a woman decide whether to carry to term or abort?
Well, it isn't the physician's place to make the decision. It's the woman's decision. All an obstetrician can do is to try to guide that woman, give her information, educate her. That's the whole purpose in my publishing this textbook on abortion and sterilization, is educate both the profession and the public as to the problems.
What are some instances where you would and some instances where you wouldn't recommend an abortion for a woman who is seeking your advice?
I have frequently advised women against it. For instance, the woman in over 30 who's never had a pregnancy, who I think might regret the fact that if she had signs of being an infertility problem. I have persuaded several medical students that I can think of, women medical students, to continue pregnancies when they were in the middle of their medical education, telling them that time was fleeting and that if they're going to have their families, they'd better have it. Or if I felt a patient was being coerced in any way, all of these things. I have refused to do abortions, and I have certainly advised any number against them. But as far as the ultimate decision, no.
What's the nature of your involvement in the abortion issue been?
Well, I've certainly been out in the forefront in Minnesota because of challenging Minnesota's law and all the publicity that ensued after that. I hoped by my trial and this open performance of an abortion with consultation on a rubella patient in whom I felt it was strongly indicated, that I would educate the public and possibly the legislature to change Minnesota law. So there was a week-long trial in which many experts came and testified, and it was well documented. This conviction was later reversed by the Minnesota Supreme Court after Roe v. Wade. And since that time, my role has been mainly to implement the law. I have not been an activist at all. I'm on the faculty at the University of Minnesota, and I've tried to provide some abortion training because it is very inadequate in the field. There are very few residencies that provide abortion training. And I felt that to try to document the safety of the procedure was extremely important because there had been so much false criticism of the dangers. They'd been greatly overrated, the dangers of abortion. And so I, along with many others, have published papers as to the safety of the procedure, and I've tried to make it available and low cost and humane. And because there are so few abortion providers, I have tended to concentrate on that simply because the profession on the whole has defaulted, I feel, in making the service available for women.
When a woman comes to you who's pregnant, what do you feel your loyalty is to the woman and to the fetus that she's carrying?
Oh, very definitely to the woman. There's no question. I have no problem differentiating at all. Medicine is full of choices. We're making choices all the time. I learned that, I think, in the developing countries where I worked under the HOPE Project in several different places and where we couldn't treat everybody and we had to choose as to what was the most effective thing to do. And when I see a patient that has a problem pregnancy, I'm considering her family, her children, her future, the whole overall picture, and not just a fertilized ovum that accidentally became fertilized. While it has significance, yes, it has much less significance. I think we should take care of the children that we have in this world rather than worrying about the ones that haven't arrived.
Do you think that the abortion issue is causing much division amongst doctors?
Not really. The American College has been very forthright in their statement of support. Dr. George Ryan, the past president, has testified before the Senate committees, and the AMA has been supportive of the Roe v. Wade decision and any number of medical organizations. There always is a minority membership, as Dr. Sullivan pointed out, to the pro-life group. I feel that they, of course, are entitled to that opinion. However, I do very strongly resent the pro-life group in the field of obstetrics and gynecology because the abortion issue comprises really such a large segment of that specialty that I think that now that if a physician feels that abortion should not be made available to women, I don't think they should go into the field. I can understand a dermatologist, or I can understand my own husband, for instance, a cardiac surgeon who is totally unaware of problem pregnancies because they aren't exposed. But to go into the specialty, then I don't think the conscience clause should apply there. I think that they're deliberately choosing something and they're going to be biased right from the start. And it really affects it isn't just abortion, it's sterilization. And as technology improves, there are going to be other things. There's test tube fertilization now, which I'm sure Dr. Sullivan doesn't approve of and would consider right along with the abortion issue. There is the artificial donor insemination, and embryo banks are now a reality in Britain. As technology improves, and genetic research, of course, is very important.
So do you think a gynecologist must be able to embrace all of
those
new things?
He must be able to. He must be sympathetic or at least make these services available to all his patients. I don't know what one does about genetic counseling if you feel strongly about abortion. There would certainly be conflicts all along the way.
Okay, I'm speaking with Dr. Jane Hodgson, and she's the director of the Midwest Medical Center for Women in Minneapolis. Also with me is Dr. Ed Sullivan, who's an obstetrician-gynecologist at Riddle Memorial Hospital in Media. Dr. Hodgson, we'll get back to you in a couple of minutes. We'll also be opening up the phones in a few minutes. Dr. Sullivan, let me ask you about a couple of the points that Dr. Hodgson brought up. Dr. Hodgson, then I'll ask you about a couple of points that Dr. Sullivan brought up. She talked about what it was like for her to witness the effects of criminal abortions, abortions that were done when it wasn't legal to do an abortion, where it was botched by someone who didn't do a good job. Did you ever witness the effects of that, and what effect did that have on you?
Oh, well, I want to state that I'm opposed to criminal abortions, too, as well as legal ones. And sure, I've seen the results of when I was in my residency training program. We had many cases where patients came in with severe infections from criminal abortions. But and I'm not in favor of criminal abortions.
Well, legal or illegal women tend to seek abortions, which are, in times when it's illegal, criminal abortions. Did the witnessing of that affect your point of view in any way?
Well, no, because I'm opposed to abortion, whether it's legal or illegal. And I'm willing to certify that Dr. Hodgson can probably do a better abortion than somebody who isn't trained to do one, which is what frequently happened in these. The illegal abortions that were done by physicians usually didn't result in these problems.
Dr. Hodgson mentioned that she feels a doctor is always in the position of having to make decisions and weighing one thing against another, and that given the choice between making a decision in favor of an accidentally fertilized ovum or a decision in favor of a woman who are already born and growing children and the rest of the family.
How do we know it was accidental? How do we know it was accidental? You said an accidentally fertilized ovum. How do we know that? We don't know that it was accidental. How do we know that it isn't part of some plan somewhere? And as I said, I've never seen any point where you had a choice, where you really have a choice. If a patient's pregnant, what you do is you take care of them. I have to admit there are problem pregnancies. But as far as I'm concerned, abortion is an unacceptable solution to that problem pregnancy. There are other solutions which are more humane, which result in a live birth rather than in a dead baby.
What are the other solutions?
Well, what's the problem? Give me the problem, I'll give you the solution.
Okay, let's mention the problem that Dr. Hodgson mentioned before.
Well, that was a hydatidiform mole, of course.
Right.
I don't think anybody disagrees that hydatidiform moles ought to be evacuated and treated.
Hypothetically, so let's say that
if it had not been a hydatid, if it had been a baby, we're talking about a social problem now. And I think once you start killing for social reasons, that's all that Nazi Germany did, was for social reasons.
I object.
We'll get to that in a moment, Dr. Hodgson. Finally, Dr. Hodgson said that she thought a doctor who couldn't, who didn't want to perform abortions shouldn't go into the field of OBGYN at this
yes,
point.
Yes, I heard. This is what I said. This is my fear. This is my fear that people of Dr. Hodgson's persuasion will someday force those of us who have this feeling toward fetal life and human life out of the profession, that we will be unable to practice our profession. I've been doing it for 25 years. Where am I supposed to go now? I mean, am I forced into retirement? If my son wanted to go into obstetrics and gynecology and follow in my path and he feels the same way, should he not be allowed to? Or should he be forced to do abortions? And I don't think anybody should be forced to do abortions.
Okay, I'm speaking with Dr. Ed Sullivan. He's an obstetrician-gynecologist at Riddle Memorial Hospital in Media. Also with me is Dr. Jane Hodgson, the director of the Midwest Medical Center for Women in Minneapolis. And Dr. Hodgson, let's discuss a couple of points that Dr. Sullivan brought up a little earlier. He said that when he became a gynecologist and took the Hippocratic Oath, included in the Hippocratic Oath was that you would not perform an abortion, and that when that was, he didn't feel good when that was taken out of the oath. How did you feel when that was taken out of the oath?
I never took the Hippocratic Oath. It isn't administered at the University of Minnesota or any place else, actually, that I know of at this point.
It isn't?
No, it is not.
Okay. He said that, Dr. Sullivan said that he thinks abortion is the equivalent of killing for social reasons and compared it to some of the crimes in Nazi Germany. How would you react to that?
Well, the Nazis were very anti. The abortion was illegal during the time of the Nazi regime. Actually, it was punishable by death. And so the Nazis did not tolerate abortion. He's totally mistaken on that. That's one of the fallacies that many of the anti-abortion people use. And it doesn't, if they really know their history, all during the time of the Hitler regime, why abortion was punishable by death.
Dr. Sullivan mentioned that neonatology, some of the breakthroughs in the technology used in monitoring the fetus and being able to also perform medical operations on the fetus, mm-hmm. has convinced him that that the fetus is really a living person and that it should be saved, and that justifies the anti-abortion stand. Does neonatology affected your point of view at all on abortion?
Not really at all. I think we have to keep changing our morality, however, with the changes in technology. And I would be interested in how Dr. Sullivan feels about the in vitro fertilization, for example. He was talking about the divine role that novum was not accidentally fertilized, that there was some divine factor that entered into that fertilization process. And yet we're able to simulate that in the laboratory now in a test tube. So that sort of takes away the divine factor, it seems to me, in the union of sperm and egg. The whole thing is divine. I am totally in awe of the process of life as a continuum. But any one step like that in saying that stopping that life cycle at one point is really any different than another, as long as your end point isn't a human being. And the in vitro fertilization and the increased technology in regard to embryo banks, for example, is going to change our whole concept.
How do you feel about in vitro fertilization? And then I'll ask Dr. Sullivan.
Well, I think it's very exciting. And I think it's the thing of the future. I think we will see there are many very unhappy, unfortunate women that are unable to conceive, and this will enable them to have children. And I think it's marvelous for those couples.
Dr. Sullivan, how do you feel about in vitro fertilization?
Well, I have no objection to in vitro fertilization as long as there are no wasted embryos. That would be my objection to it, as long as it. And I don't remember mentioning any divine plan, but I'll go along with it. I wouldn't say that it wasn't part of the divine plan if it's in vitro fertilization. What I said is we can't tell. We can't tell. In vitro fertilization itself doesn't bother me. What bothers me is what happens to other fertilized ovum. Embryo banks bother me a great deal, a great deal. I just, that gives me the creeps. That's Brave New World with Aldous Huxley.
Why does that bother you?
Well, I'm not as excited about in vitro fertilization as Dr. Hodgson is. I'm excited about it for those people about whom she talks, who have no other way of becoming pregnant. But I would still like to see fertilization remain a home and cottage industry rather than an industrial one.
Dr. Hodgson, how do you feel about, I forget what the term is already, embryo banks?
Well, it's still very new. I think that I really haven't had any occasion to make any decision about them. I think it's exciting, too, because, again, it will increase the ability of infertility patients it'll help women control their reproduction. What Dr. Sullivan says, though, about destroying the fertilized ovum, then he would obviously be against IUDs, because of course they act as abortifacients and prevent implantation of fertilized ova. So I assume then from his remarks that he would be really anti-contraception, because many of the contraceptive pills act that way too, preventing implantation.
She assumes too much.
Good.
Do you want to just respond to that?
Well, I am opposed to IUDs, but not on the basis of it being an abortive fashion, because I don't think that's really been absolutely proven. Dr. Luigi Mastriani in town here at the University of Pennsylvania put a lot of IUDs in sheep, and many of them didn't ovulate. So I don't know. The reason I'm opposed to IUDs is because of all the pelvic inflammatory disease I've seen as a result of them. They get a much better press than the pill, and the only reason I can think of is that they are the darling of Planned Parenthood, because the controllers can control. You put an IUD in, and it stays there until somebody takes it out. You give somebody a prescription for the pill, they may not get it filled. You can even give them the pills. They may not take them. But what they like is to have control. If they put the IUD in, then they're in control of the situation. Patient's not in control. They're in control.
What do you think of the IUD?
Well, that's a little off the subject.
It is, isn't it?
I agree with Dr. Sullivan. I think in 10 years they'll be taken off the market because of the pelvic infection that they cause and the decrease in fertility. No, I think they're dangerous. And however, in select cases, they're a godsend too, where women can't have a sterilization procedure. And I'm thinking of the woman who's had her family, and they have in select cases are great. But as a general rule, particularly women who've never had a pregnancy, I never will insert one in a woman who hasn't been pregnant. Almost never.
See, we can agree on something.
Yes, we do.
Let me reintroduce you both for our listeners just joining us. My guests are Dr. Ed Sullivan and Dr. Jane Hodgson. Dr. Sullivan is with Riddle Memorial Hospital in Media, and Dr. Hodgson is based in Minneapolis, where she's the director of a women's health center. Dr. Hodgson advocates the right to choose abortion. Dr. Sullivan is opposed to abortion. We'd like to open up the phones and invite you to call with any questions that you have, and it should be kept to the subject of abortion. Our number is 923-2774. We're at area code 215. The number again, 923-2774, and our phone lines are now open. As we're waiting for our listeners to call, there's a couple of questions I'd like to ask you both to respond to. What do you think the medical and social effects of illegal abortion would be, or of highly restrictive abortion, if any of the current amendments that are proposed pass? Dr. Hodgson?
First of all, it would be very difficult to provide good health care for the women under such a circumstance. It would outlaw the IUDs and other forms of contraception, some of them. It would cause genetic research to halt, and it would make it very difficult to take care of women with threatened abortion or women for any other medical reason, because you would have to continually do pregnancy testing to be sure that they weren't pregnant if you were under criminal sanction to protect that fertilized ovum in the event that they were pregnant. So it would make health care rather difficult, extremely difficult, plus the fact that there would be more criminal abortions, and there would be more problem pregnancies.
Dr. Sullivan?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that nobody aborts a fertilized ovum. It's always much farther along than that by the time they get an abortion. They're usually 5-6 weeks pregnant at the earliest. They seldom, unless they get a menstrual extraction or something like that. And even at that stage, it's beyond the fertilized ovum stage. I think what this would do, there are so many different proposals that are on the books that it's hard to respond to what all of them do. Well, let's take the most extreme case of a human life amendment were passed. What this would do would be provide the fetus with the same right to life that you and I have, that it could not be done away with without due process of law. And I don't think that that's a bad thing at all.
Okay. Of the various amendments that and legislation that are pending on a federal level, Dr. Sullivan, do you have any that you support more than another?
Oh, yes. I like the Human Life Amendment much better than the others. I like them all. I would support anything that would give some measure of protection to the fetus.
Why do you choose the Human Life Amendment above the others?
Well, because that would, first of all, it would be an amendment to the Constitution and not just a law. And therefore, it couldn't possibly be declared unconstitutional because it's a constitutional amendment. And I think it provides the greatest margin of protection for the fetus.
Dr. Hodgson, I imagine you're opposed to all of the proposed legislation. Is there one that you're more strongly opposed to than another?
Well, I would be more strongly opposed. I don't think it really matters because the ultimate end of all of them is to reverse Roe v. Wade and make abortion illegal. It's just one, they're trying to figure out politically which one would get there the fastest. And, of course, it would be a major disaster for women's reproductive rights. I would see that women would be set back several decades, back to where we were really before 1960 with the advent of the birth control pill.
Okay, well, let's open up the phones for our listeners' questions. Our number is 923-2774. I have two guests just speaking with Dr. Jane Hodgson, who both my guests are obstetrician-gynecologists. Dr. Hodgson is for a woman's right to choose abortion. Dr. Ed Sullivan, who is also an obstetrician-gynecologist, is opposed to abortion. And let's go to the phones. Hello, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, hello, Terry. First of all, I want to commend you for having both sides of the issue on. And I want to comment on the parallel between Nazism and abortionism. And I would like to point out that the issue in both cases is not whether abortion was legal under Nazism, but it has to do with the oppression and the systematic destruction of a group of people for a perceived social end. Under Nazism, Jews were considered to be non-people. Under the Dred Scott decision in this country, blacks were considered to be non-people. And under the abortion laws, unborn are considered to be non-people. We had one time in Western culture, in the Greek culture, born babies being killed, particularly females, if it was inconvenient for the family. And what I'm seeing coming on our culture right now is that sort of attitude toward human life. At the University of Pennsylvania recently, I know someone who went into a room and found aborted fetuses that had been aborted by means of a hysterotomy, which is a cesarean section performed on six-month-old fetuses. There were live fetuses in the laboratory existent, which is illegal. And I think we ought to be concerned with the oppression of all, the oppression of women, and also the oppression of unborn women and unborn men.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Do you have any comments, either of you, that you'd like to make on that?
I think this is all memorized, and he really whipped it off. And there was a great deal of fallacy in many of his comments. I haven't time to go into it.
Dr. Sullivan? Agree with him.
Okay. Let's take the next phone call. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. I would like to direct my question to Dr. Sullivan concerning a statement that he made from Dr. Hodgson stating, why should he be forced to perform abortions when he chooses not to perform them by saying that I couldn't, you know, stay in the profession if I don't want to perform an abortion, I can't stay in. Well, why should he have the right not to perform it, and a woman who needs it or wants it not have the right to do it? You know, in other words, he has a double standard here, I think, Dr. Sullivan has.
I don't think so. I don't have to perform appendectomies. Why is abortion so special? Why must I be forced to do abortions? Why am I not forced to do lung surgery, cardiac surgery? None of these things. These are all options one has. You do not have to. There are many operations in gynecology that I don't perform because I don't have special knowledge of them. I'm sure Dr. Hodgson has the same way. Now, why should I be forced out of gynecology because I don't do microsurgery on tubes?
Well, it's not that you're being forced out. You've chosen that field of medicine, and abortions are part of it. You're supposed to take care of the right of the patient and the patient's wishes. And I think that by not allowing the patient to make a choice, even though you make a choice, isn't fair. It really isn't. You're making a choice not to and saying, I'm not doing it, therefore you can't do it because I don't want to do it. I don't think that kind of a reasoning and then is valid. I mean, you're
okay, let's if you could just sum up so we can have a response.
Okay, well, I don't really have any more to say other than I was trying to make that a little more clear.
Okay. Would either of you like to comment on that?
I'd like to comment that actually that is not the role. The role of the physician is not to provide the patient with what the patient wants. The role of the physician is to provide the patient with what's good for her and what's right. If a patient comes in and wants a hysterectomy, I'm sure Dr. Hodgson or I would just say, oh, certainly, it's legal. You can have it. I'll give it to you. So you don't have to perform surgery on patients simply because they want it.
Dr. Hodgson?
Well, abortion is in a little different category, and there are, I would remind you, is a million and a half that are being performed every year. So that's a lot. That's a lot of operative procedures, and it's a big portion of the field of obstetrics and gynecology. It's quite a bit different than doing microsurgery on tubes. There aren't anywhere near that number of tubal operations being done.
But just to get back to something you said before, Dr. Sullivan, you felt that you were not in any danger of being forced to perform abortions if abortions remain
legal. Not
at
this particular time, but I fear Dr. Hodgson's point of view that eventually I will, and of course I will leave the profession at that point.
Okay, let's take another phone call. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes. I'd like to pose a hypothetical question to Dr. Sullivan. I find myself 6 weeks pregnant, and I come to him as a patient, and I have just contracted German measles. I wonder what Dr. Sullivan would advise me to do, or what he would do in that case.
Well, in the first place, why do you have German measles? Why weren't you immunized against it?
Well, I'm poor, and I didn't know about it. I'm ignorant, perhaps, of that, and I just the fact is I have German measles now, and I'm 6 weeks pregnant.
Well, hard cases make bad law, and, you know, you can think up, you could pose a case to me if the nation's survival was at stake, would I do an abortion? And I don't think we ought to answer iffy questions here. As Franklin Roosevelt once said, I don't answer iffy questions. And that's an iffy question.
Is it that iffy that someone would come to you pregnant with German measles?
I think it's very iffy.
Well, I have nothing more to say.
Okay, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yeah, I think this issue is going to be decided in Washington, and nobody's really mentioned Washington yet. So I'd ask both guests what you'd say to the suggestion that there probably won't ever be a Congress as sympathetic to the anti-abortion movement as the current one, and that if the economy is bad this November and Democrats make gains in Congress, then an amendment could become permanently a political impossibility.
Dr. Hodgson, you want to comment?
Well, I'm not sure I heard all of that, but I think I agree with everything he said. I think it's a definite a possibility that an amendment could be in the books because we do have a very sympathetic Congress right now. That's the whole purpose of my being here and speaking, coming forth and speaking out on this issue because I fear it is a real possibility and it would be such a tragedy that I would like to alert the women as to the possibility.
Dr. Sullivan, do you want to comment?
Oh, I would hope that we'd get an even more sympathetic Congress in the future times because I don't like to take comfort in Dr. Hodgson's fears, but I think her fears are overblown. I can't see us getting a human life amendment this session, although I'd love it to happen.
Okay, thank you very much for your phone call.
Uh-huh.
Okay, bye-bye. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Good afternoon. I have a quick question addressed to Dr. Hodgson and to Dr. Sullivan, and this question is, in order to truly protect choice and life, do you both believe that the dollars and support services necessary to raise a child be ultimately guaranteed by society?
I couldn't get that.
Oh, in order to, do you want to repeat your question?
Sure. In order to truly protect choice and life, do you both believe that the dollars and support services necessary to raise a child be ultimately guaranteed by society?
Do you understand the question? That do you think that it should be guaranteed that a woman who is pregnant and is giving birth has income provided for her to raise the child, to feed it and clothe it and shelter it? Do you think that that kind of money should be guaranteed to bring up a child?
By whom?
By society, by the government, if it comes to that.
I thought we already had that pretty much.
Well, the woman, the Vietnamese woman who had four children.
Aid to dependent children.
The present situation, a woman who opts for abortion gets no financial support from the government whatsoever, whereas a woman who chooses to carry her pregnancy to term will, at least at the present time, is getting AFDC and medical assistance
but is that
to
adequate?
A degree.
I don't think that's really adequate, though, to raise a child. I mean,
I can't hear him.
He says he doesn't think it's adequate to raise a child.
It's not adequate, but at least it's better. It's something. The woman who chooses to terminate gets no support whatsoever.
Okay, thank you very much for your phone call.
Okay,
bye-bye. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to direct a question to Dr. Hodgson. She made some comments about the time of illegal abortions of the people coming in with complications, and I just want to know how many and where she got her statistics from. Could she prove those points? Because I've had people tell me to the opposite, that that's so overblown about people coming in with all these problems and the wards being filled.
Dr. Hartson?
Well, I don't know how old you are, but I've been in practice for over 30 years, and all I can say is that it's a common part of medicine, the practice of gynecology in the city hospitals. I can remember wards full of such patients in Jersey City and also in Minneapolis General Hospital. I've just returned last year from a year in Egypt where I was visiting professor at Al-Azhar Medical School in Cairo. And I was there the whole year, and I saw as an example of a society where abortion is illegal. As many women came in every day to the hospital with infected abortions as came in to have babies. It averaged about 30 a day at the El Galah Hospital in Cairo. This is certainly enough documentation, I think, of the. I have all kinds of references, and much has been written about the increased maternal mortality in countries where abortion is illegal. Everywhere else in the world, it has dropped remarkably once abortion becomes legalized.
Dr. Sullivan, does your experience jive with it?
Well, I don't think the maternal mortality rate drops because abortion is legal. I don't think our maternal mortality rate has appreciably changed since the 1973 decision. We've got it almost at an irreducible minimum at the present time. I believe in the city of Philadelphia, it's very small. Let's put it that way. Very, very small. But it hasn't really dropped that much in the past 7 years. I don't think that.
Do you recall where Dr. Hodgson mentioned wards full of women
coming
in with infected germs?
I recall what Dr. Hodgson is talking about. There were several. There are no question about it. There are severe complications from not just an illegal abortion, but what it is a contaminated abortion. You can get severe infections from that. But you can get severe infections from the legal ones. I still see occasional complications from them. I'm sure Dr. Hodgson sees. And I don't do any abortions. They get dumped on me.
Okay, thanks so much for your phone call. Bye-bye now. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, I would like to ask a question, Dr. Hodgson. I believe she mentioned the figure of 40,000 abortions that she has either performed herself or supervised. Is that correct?
Correct.
I was wondering how many of those were performed free of charge?
Oh, very many of them.
Very many. Can you say a percentage or a figure?
You mean from a personal point of view? I work for a nonprofit organization, so I am not collecting on each abortion. Many of these are done at reduced rates. They are done when we started in Washington in 1972, the charge for a first trimester abortion was $135, which was no margin for any profit, you can see, that really just simply covered the cost. The present time, all right, where we are providing services, first trimester abortions are $195, and this is including contraception, counseling, antibiotics, Rogam, the works, so that the margin for profit is extremely low.
But there usually is a charge made, and people are making money out of it.
Well, no, they are not.
Well, they're being paid salaries. They are given jobs in order to provide this
service. That's right. They are providing jobs. That's correct.
Okay. Now, if I may, I'd like to ask one more question. Before the Supreme Court decision, are there any kind of real statistics about how many abortions were performed?
No. It's very...
Not even an approximation.
It's impossible to get any such statistics.
Would you be willing to comment on whether or not it was anywhere near the over a million a year in the United States?
It was probably every bit as many, if not more.
You believe that? And
yeah,
yet you
indeed,
have no statistic
I do.
Whatsoever to base
I'm,
that on.
I'm quite sure of it.
Well, how can you be sure if you have absolutely no statistic?
Well, statistics estimates can be made by demographers and statisticians on the basis of the admissions, for instance, of criminal abortions, on the death figures, all of those things. They estimate the number of abortions, for instance, in South America, where abortion is illegal, and in most of the developing countries where abortion is legal, criminal abortion is considered the most important cause of maternal mortality.
Thank you for your call. We want to give somebody else a chance.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to say that I think abortion is not a good idea, but I think that a woman who is forced to have a child, forced to carry a child, would have the tendency to become sadomasochistic, possibly harm... I think there's a great possibility of her harming the child through use of drugs or alcohol to... in her state, she's going to be depressed if she's forced to carry a baby she doesn't want. And I think the baby could be malformed because of it. I was wondering what they thought about that.
Any comments?
No comment.
No comment. No. Okay. Thank you very much for your call.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. Hello, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hello. I have a question I'd like to address to Dr. Hodgson. Inasmuch as human pregnancy is not a hermaphroditic process, inasmuch as there are males involved, I would like Dr. Hodgson to comment on whether what she sees as the rights of the male in determining when a pregnancy or if a pregnancy should be terminated.
Dr. Hodgson had trouble hearing you, so I'll repeat that for you. He wanted to know what the right of a man should be in the decision to carry to term or to terminate a pregnancy.
Well, ideally, of course, he should have a very important role, but the way society is set up at this point, it certainly isn't a prerequisite by any means. And it's the woman ultimately who has to carry that pregnancy and is responsible. So it really is a woman's decision, not the man's. I'm not saying that it isn't ideal that the male should take equal participation.
Okay, thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to ask Dr. Sullivan two questions. First, did you actually take the Hippocratic Oath? If so, which form, the original form or that produced by the Christian Medical Society? The second question, isn't the essence of morality the human predicament of being uncomfortable simply because we're not God?
Well, to answer your first question first, I didn't take it in the original Greek, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't the Christian Medical Society's oath. I took it in 1952 when I finished medical school, and that was part of the graduation ceremonies.
Which medical school was that?
Temple University.
Temple. Mm-hmm.
And
that's one of the few that does, apparently, then.
Your second question, would you repeat your second question? I don't think I quite caught that.
You said several times you felt uncomfortable about things, and I said, isn't that the actual human predicament, if we're going to be moral people, that we have to make choices and be uncomfortable simply because we're not God?
Yes, I guess I would agree with that statement.
Yeah. In other words, the time comes when we don't feel uncomfortable. Maybe we've become rather dogmatic and have assumed the position of God. Isn't that the danger of an absolute ethic?
I suppose. I'm not a moralist, so I don't know.
Could you answer one other brief question? Does Temple give any courses on ethics in medicine? And are they required, or...?
It gave a... Well, you're asking me to look back a long time. Yes, it gave a course in medical ethics, but it didn't have anything in it about abortion at that time.
No, I just meant about ethics in medical practice.
Yes, it did.
Was it elective or a required part?
It was a required course.
Okay, thank you so much for your calls. Do want to get some other people. Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
My question is directed to Dr. Sullivan. I always thought that an independent organism that lived inside another independent organism, that fed off that organism, breathed through that organism, and disposed of its waste through that organism, was technically a parasite. And if that is correct, what right does anyone have to tell a woman that she has to be a broodmare for the state?
She has to be a broodmare for the state? I don't think.
Correct.
I told women that they had to be broodmares for the state.
If you oppose abortion under all circumstances, that means compulsory pregnancy.
I don't think that follows at all.
Oh, I
There's
think
no
it follows
compulsion
very well.
For them to get pregnant.
Hey,
no compulsion at all for them to get pregnant.
There is no foolproof method of birth control.
That's a true statement.
Well, then, if one gets pregnant through not one's own fault, then if one has to carry a child, then one is becoming a broodmare for the state.
Well, I don't think that follows at all.
I had four children.
I don't think my wife was a broodmare for the state.
Was it voluntary?
You bet they were voluntary.
Okay, I'm talking about involuntary pregnancies.
I'm not familiar with involuntary pregnancy. Are you speaking about rape?
Where you've been all these years.
Oh, I've been around here practicing medicine.
Okay, thanks so much for your phone call. Dr. Hodgson, did you want to comment on that?
Well, I think that patients know what a physician's attitude is, and they consciously or unconsciously seek out a physician that will be sympathetic. I think that's why I've seen more problem pregnancies, perhaps, than Dr. Sullivan. And I would assume that many of the women who are seeking, who have problem pregnancies, would go elsewhere.
Dr. Sullivan?
Well, I just solve the problems a little differently than Dr. Hodgson does. I think I see as many problem pregnancies.
Okay, let's take another phone call. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi. I don't think, my opinion is that this should not be a matter of law at all. This is really government invasion of the privacy of people's lives. And if this were not a matter of law, it wouldn't be a matter of public controversy. This is a private matter between the two parties involved and their doctor. And then there wouldn't be any discussion of when life begins or ends or anything like that, unless the state is prepared to provide adequately for every child born, it seems to me, then it has to keep out of the private affairs of the people involved. If it were not a matter of law, we would have no more arguments about whether 100,000 Chinamen can fit on the head of a pin. And I don't think it's a matter for medical or scientific discussion at all.
Dr. Sullivan?
Well, the reason you have laws is to protect the weak.
We don't need protection, thank you. I think
underestimate... Don't take the subway home tonight,
people.
Then, if you don't need protection.
I beg your pardon?
I said, don't take the subway tonight if you don't need protection. Of course you need protection.
I've taken the subway many times, and that's my choice. I have the right to choose whether I ride in the subway or not.
Of course you do, but the mugger that hits you in the...
And the government has absolutely no right to invade the privacy of my life, my bedroom, or whether or not my husband and I, or my lover and I, or my children's lover decide to have a child.
Let's get back to her original question about it being an invasion of privacy, she says, and also that if a government is going to outlaw abortion, then they should take it upon themselves to provide for the child. Can you respond to those?
Yeah, I would agree with her last statement that the government has no business in her bedroom and whether she gets pregnant or not. You need the law to protect the weak. That's what protects us.
Define the weak for me, then. Define the weak.
Define the weak.
Yes,
the weak.
Define what you mean by weak.
I mean myself if some mugger comes up because I'm not very big and they could take my money. But that's illegal to do that. Now, it gets done every day, but that doesn't mean that the law is bad.
That is like apples and oranges. That has nothing to do with abortion and birth and when life begins and whether or not women and men should be prevented from having legal abortions or illegal abortions. If a woman wants an abortion, she should have it.
Dr. Hartson, did you want to respond to that?
Well, I agree with the caller. I certainly think that it's an invasion of privacy, and it's an invasion of my right to practice medicine in the way in which I see fit. I don't think the abortion service should be treated any differently than any other medical service.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for your phone call. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
I think we won't really have time for any more phone calls. So let me ask you if you'd each like to take a minute to sum up your position and tell us what, perhaps if you'd like, what you think will happen in the next year, Dr. Hartson?
Well, I sincerely hope that we will not be forced to take a step backward in women's fight for reproductive control. We've achieved a great deal in the last 20 years. At the present time, only 8% of the world lives under restrictive abortion laws. And I hope that we won't step backwards and join that very small minority. The one bright spot is that there are no democracies that have become more restrictive once their abortion laws have been liberalized. There have been only two of Israel and New Zealand.
Okay, Dr. Sullivan?
Well, I think it's a sad commentary on our times when abortion is regarded as a step forward in women's rights, because abortion ultimately is the taking of an innocent, weak human life. And if we're supposed to do anything in this world, what we're supposed to do is protect and succor the downtrodden and the weak. And we were never weaker than when we were fetuses. And I also notice that all the people that are for abortion are already born. We don't have any comments from the fetuses. They have no lobby at all, except for people like myself.
Okay, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us, and I want to thank our callers as well who participated. With me has been Dr. Ed Sullivan, who's an obstetrician-gynecologist at Riddle Memorial Hospital in Media. He's also on the faculty of the Jefferson Medical College. Also with me has been Dr. Jane Hodgson, who's visiting Philadelphia today from Minneapolis, where she's the director of the Midwest Center for Women. She's also the author of a new book called Abortion and Sterilization, Medical and Social Aspects, published by the Academic Press. Thanks again to both of you for being with us. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, I'll be joined by Anthony Crivello, and he's now starring in the production of Evita. He's playing in the role of Che. I understand he'll be leaving this production soon for Broadway, where he will be playing that role. At 3:30 tomorrow afternoon, Francis Davis and this week's edition of Interval. So I hope you can join us then. Contributing to this afternoon's Fresh Air was John Swed. The production assistant for the program is Maeve McGoran. The associate producer is Danny Miller. And the technical director this afternoon has been Joyce Lieberman. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I wish you a very good evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Support for this program comes from the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Joyce Foundation for Midwestern coverage, the Pew Memorial Trust for historical reporting, and the Chubb Group of Insurance Companies, worldwide personal and commercial insurance underwriters. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Sanford Unger.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.
People are still hesitant in Alabama to say they're Republican because they visualize the guy with the big black suit on, you know, and he's got a diamond stick pin in his tie. With the personality of Ronald Reagan, you know, chopping wood and cowboy and actor, had dissipated that feeling until yesterday at the Civic Center when you see the president if you got $500.
The South was once solidly Democratic, but in 1980 it was almost solidly Ronald Reagan. However, this week when the president traveled south, the reaction was mixed. Alabamians fear a depression, and Alabama Republicans worry about their party's image. Tonight in All Things Considered, how it's playing in Montgomery.
Also for St. Patrick's Day, the new Irish Prime Minister at the White House.
A dog show in Dublin, the place to be today.
And a complaint about how Americans have corrupted an Irish holiday.
Throw the bums out, the theme of yesterday's voting in the Illinois primary.
A turnaround on warning labels for cigarettes.
Congress has ideas on immigration reform, more restrictive policies.
Violence on the Golan Heights.
How a historian puts his mind in the times he's writing about.
And let's play engineer on All Things Considered. First, this news from John Hockenberry.
They're racing the clock in Fort Wayne, Indiana, where the severe floods have already forced 8,000 people to flee their homes. The city's three rivers have all spilled over their banks, and damage estimates have risen to $16 million. But the worst may be yet to come. Bruce Hetrick of the mayor's office says the rivers continue to rise.
They are approximately 11 feet over the flood stage right now and are not supposed to crest until Thursday or Friday. We are still sandbagging all of the dikes throughout the city. We have closed all of the high schools in town. They closed voluntarily, and the students are out on the streets with sandbags, filling them, placing them out along the dikes.
The city has now opened 11 emergency Red Cross shelters to house the homeless. There's also flooding in Ohio and southern Michigan caused by days of rain and melting snow. A bill designed to stop a flood of immigrants to this country was introduced in Congress today, and the Reagan administration quickly moved to support it. At the present time, there is no overall limit on the number of legal aliens admitted to the U.S. The bill, sponsored by Representative Roman Mazzoli and Senator Alan Simpson, would place a 425,000-person ceiling on yearly immigration. The plan would also impose stiff fines and jail terms on employers who knowingly hire illegal aliens, a provision some business leaders say is too costly and bureaucratic, but co-sponsor Mazzoli says the benefits of controlling immigration are worth the cost.
I guess maybe it can become burdensome of a fashion, but I think much more burdensome is 6.5 million people in the United States without documents. Much more burdensome is a porous border that lets people come in to the tune of 1,000 a day, 500,000 a year. Much more to the point is an underclass which has existed to be exploited and are very vulnerable to the outrageous tactics of some employers. That's what we want to cure.